One of the greatest problems of our time, wrote St. Thomas More back in the 16th century, is that many are schooled, but few are educated. My, how little has changed since the 16th century. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College. Once each semester here at the college, we hold the all-school seminar. Our entire community reads the same work, and the student body and faculty are divided into seminar groups led by our seniors. Last week, the whole college discussed Robert Bolt's play about St. Thomas More, A Man for All Seasons. More, who along with Henry VIII, was a staunch defender of the Catholic faith, was also a favorite of the king's and eventually became Lord Chancellor, until Henry, wanting to divorce Catherine of Aragon, his queen, declared himself the head of the Church of England to get a divorce and to marry Anne Boleyn. More quit his high post, hoping to avoid conflict with the king. It didn't work. I asked our dean, Professor Kyle Washett, to tell us more about the all-school seminar and about A Man for All Seasons.
So we do the all-school seminars twice a year, once in the fall semester, once in the spring semester. And we want to do two things. On the one hand, we want to give our seniors a chance to be leaders in a unique way. They've spent 4 years working as studying the great books, working in the seminars, listening to people in conversations. And we're hoping that graduates are going to be invited to lead book discussions, either at the local library, in their future teaching, or whatever the case may be. And so we'd like to give them a chance to practice that. So on the one hand, that's the seniors take a leadership role.
Yeah, we faculty just sit around.
It's great. You know, we end up meeting with them, mentoring them, talk and sort of pull back the curtain a little bit about what do you do when you prep a discussion class. So it's delightful in that regard. The other advantage of mixing all of the classes and faculty and staff is that it reminds us that in the end we're doing one thing together. But it's hard to remember when you're a freshman and you're doing Euclid and the seniors haven't done Euclid, they're doing Einstein now. It's hard to remember that, oh, we're doing one thing because that one thing is spread out over 4 years. Same for the faculty. We're all doing one thing, this one common project. And for the staff, we're doing this one common project, but we're doing it in radically different ways. It's great to have one chance where the entire community gets together and we're going to read one book together and we're going to talk about it. We'll mix up the sections, we'll mix up the students. And in terms of reminding us about what we're doing, it's great.
Well, and it was so helpful. Early in the play, Machiavelli is mentioned by the characters. This is new guy from Italy who just published this book. The seniors, well, you guys haven't read, well, let us tell you about Machiavelli. And it was great.
Yeah, it's this moment where I think the freshmen are able to see a glimpse of what they have to aspire to. The seniors are able to remember, wow, we've really learned something. The juniors and the sophomore, somewhere in between. And it really is this moment of sharing common reflection.
Now, why did we choose Robert Bolt's A Man for All Seasons?
In part, we were looking for the spring semester in general, we very often end up doing a reading that's more pertinent to something bubbling in the contemporary sphere. So we've had readings about transgenderism, we've had readings about homosexual rights, we've had readings about environmentalism. And this semester we were thinking sort of bubbling in the contemporary, in the world sphere is very much the question of religiously formed conscience and state law. But we thought if we got something that was immediately pertinent to one of the burning questions in modern discourse, it might be a little bit too hot to handle. We weren't going to have a calm, dispassionate conversation amongst all of us about the question of vaccines or mandates or anything. So let's take it out. Let's take a literary piece that embodies precisely that question and let us think about the principles of it.
Good. And give us an overview of the play and the life of St. Thomas More.
So the play itself is written by a man who's not a believer, but was just struck by the witness of St. Thomas More, who was at the point of his death, had been the Chancellor of England, close friend of Henry VIII, and one of the renowned scholars of the age. And the play centers on the crisis of conscience for Thomas More, who wants to be loyal to his post, wants to serve his country, wants to serve his king, wants to be a husband that provides for his wife and daughter, and at the same time is being confronted and being asked by Henry to claim that Henry is able to divorce his wife, that he had received permission from the Pope to marry in a special circumstance, that he wants to divorce her and marry someone else. And when the Pope denies him that, Henry claims that, well, he doesn't need the Pope's permission because Henry is the head of the Church of England. And so More, as a devout Catholic, believing in the sanctity of marriage and believing in the patron primacy and its headship over the Church, is trying to navigate how to be a loyal follower of the laws while maintaining his conscience. And spoiler alert, he's not able to do both and is therefore... Well, he does a very good job, but in the end, someone is hired to perjure against him, and because of the false testimony, More is sentenced to death and killed.
Mm-hmm. Well, the play begins with the common man, who is, over the course of the drama, becomes More's butler, a boatman, a jailer, and finally the executioner. Quote, "The 16th century is the century of the common man," he announces, "like all other centuries. And that's my proposition." What do we make of this ubiquitous and odd figure?
Yeah, it's a very strange figure that doesn't make it into either of the film adaptions of Man for All Seasons. The film adaptions are both wonderful, but the common man doesn't fit as much on cinema as it does on play. And it seems that there Bolt really wants to contrast what he sees as the unique greatness of More with the kind of nameless blending of persons that is the common man. The common man throughout the play makes various comments about, why is More wasting his time? Why is he so concerned with this? He's willing to make a buck. He's willing to go here or there. He is, in a certain sense, the less refined embodiment of the position of Cromwell in the play, which is all of life is for the sake of convenience and efficiency. And the common man seems to be playing that out at the level of sort of street wisdom as opposed to sophisticated Machiavellian thought.
Mm-hmm. Cromwell and Rich in the play are, I was thinking of an old Groucho Marx line where he says, "And those are my principles, and if you don't like them, I have others."
Exactly. That there's these people, that the common man doesn't think about principles at all.
Mm-hmm.
Cromwell at least thinks about the fact that he doesn't have principles. And thinks it's a good thing, thinks that in the end, politics isn't about principles, politics is about getting things done. He even has that point of, normally marriage is of such a minor issue in the running of the state that we let the priests deal with it. But when it matters, we can't leave it to the priests anymore, right? And you get that sort of vibe occasionally even in today's discourse. Well, when your religion is something that is safe and unimportant, we leave it to you and the priests. But the moment you start claiming religion has an impact on what we can do in the public square, all of a sudden it ceases being the prerogative of the priests because the only principle is what gets things done.
Now, More, after resigning from politics, he just decides, I'm not going to even deal with this question. I'm just going to resign, live a quiet life, and live a quiet life especially by exercising silence. I'm not even going to tell my family what I think, even though everybody can guess. He doesn't flee the country. But he believes instead that because he's silent, the law is his protector. Was he simply naive about that?
That's what we were wondering in our seminar, right? Was More just wrong, right? Is More at the level of political calculus, does he really think people are going to just follow the law no matter what, and therefore he's safe? And one of the people in our seminar, and I don't know how the different sections discussed it, but one of the people in our seminar said that for More, following the law is not just a political method to get what he wants, namely to be safe. For More, that's part of the integrity of who he is. What he does is he keeps his oaths, he follows his conscience, and he follows the law. Whereas for Cromwell, following the law, it's just a useful tool. For More, it really does seem to be a matter of principle, and he hopes that he'll stay safe, and he even says at the end, "And if by following the law and doing the just thing, that's not enough to keep me alive, I actually don't want to remain living in England."
Yeah. Well, once he's condemned to death because of his old friend's perjury And there's that wonderful line, he's become the something of Wales. And Moore says, how does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? But for Wales? If you're Welsh, we apologize, but not our line. But he finally opens up, declaring that the king's being declared supreme head of the church, quote, is directly repugnant to the law of God. And then he goes on, also repugnant to the king's oath of office, also repugnant to the Magna Carta, but it's repugnant to the law of God, and thus is no law at all? Is that what he's getting at?
Yeah, that seems to be the point. Yes, seems to be the point, right? That I've held my breath. I haven't said anything. I've let you say that's the law. But now that it's come to this, I'm going to say, yeah, there is no real law that opposes the law of God. It's not in Parliament's competence to make a law opposed to God's law. Mm-hmm. It's just outside of their jurisdiction.
And claiming control over the church is the secular authorities grabbing spiritual authority.
Exactly. Exactly. He also makes the point earlier when he's talking to Cromwell, Moore says that the magistrate who is so concerned to know what the secret hearts of his citizens are, he says even that is cutting through an area that is beyond the scope of the magistrate. Mm-hmm. I'm so concerned to make sure you're thinking the right thing.
He cried.
And he says, look, if you pursue this, Cromwell, you'll end up destroying the citizenry. You'll have no good citizens because you'll have hollowed them out in your concern for making sure their thoughts of their heart are right. Mm-hmm. Again, these limits on the competency of the public authority.
Right. Well, and the limits of the law. The law can judge what we do.
Exactly.
The law should have no business judging what we think.
And precisely because the law can't get there, that sort of lets you see why Moore thinks the law of God limits the civil law. Mm-hmm. The law of God deals with being good or being bad men. The law of God deals with the secrets of the heart. And as a result, it has to hem in what the civil law can. And if the civil law doesn't fit within those frames, if it starts trying to exceed its grasp, it's going to start doing things that the law of God does. Judging whether this man's really good in his heart, ignoring the policies and procedures of men to really punish or really praise this person. And all of a sudden, you've gotten into a very dangerous wasteland.
Mm-hmm. How does the story of Thomas More speak to us today?
One of the questions we ask the students is, there's three men that invoke their conscience in the play. More, sort of consistently, is the hero. King Henry VIII, who says, the Pope can't tell me that I'm not sinning when I know in my heart I'm sinning, which is Henry's justification for divorcing his wife. And Henry's concern about sinning is maybe a little nuanced by the fact that he's carrying on a public affair with this other woman. But still, he seems to be invoking his conscience. The Pope can't tell me I'm not sinning when I know I'm sinning.
He even quotes scripture.
He quotes scripture to justify it. And then the man who will become Roper's son-in-law, Moore's son-in-law, Roper, who also is all about principle and all about conscience. And in some ways, it seems to me that those give us examples of types that we see in debating our current relationship to the laws that are most under dispute right now. That there are folks who very hotly, on one side or the other, whether it's the mandate issue or any number of other issues, come down saying, this is my conscience and here I'll stand. And it's not clear they've thought deeply about it, but they feel deeply about it. And they're going to act without sort of careful reflection about all the nuances of their action, but they're feeling so strong, they're going to act against, according to principle. And Moore says the concern about those people is their principles can change so quickly. It's not that they don't really feel the need to follow conscience, but what their conscience demands they do today is radically different than what it did yesterday.
Oh, and of course, Roper begins in the beginning of the play, he's a Lutheran.
He's a Lutheran. And then in the middle of the play, he's calling Moore a martyr and how he's a hero and should go out and preach. And then at the end of the play, he's there with Moore's daughter trying to convince Moore to take the oath.
Mm-hmm. But he's a Catholic again.
But he's a Catholic again.
Yeah, right.
So all of a sudden, you have this guy who's principles we've seen change radically intently and call for radical intense action. in a certain way that seems heroic, because he's willing to do the great thing for his conscience, but his conscience itself wobbles. And then you have Henry again, this character who's willing to use conscience to justify whatever political thing that he really wants to do. So again, when you think about what our current debates are about the religious laws, we've got, or about laws that enter into the purview of religion, we have people claiming, maybe without, not, there are at least a number of people claiming without a lot of reflection that this is this thing that they're holding to wholeheartedly and they're going to follow it. And you have the feeling that that could change with the day. There's others who are claiming by conscience they have to do something. And you know that that invocation of conscience seems to be a cover for them just justifying whatever power grab they're trying to make. And then it seems to me that we all want to be the Thomas Mores, the ones who are really committed to our obligation as citizens to help provide for the good of the Commonwealth and the common good and observe the laws as best we can, but who are also deeply aware that there are limits to what those laws can do. And as we try to keep our families safe and try to serve our nation and serve our God, Thomas More seems like a pretty good example to start with.
The late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, a great fan of St. Thomas More, told the Knights of Columbus, quote, "God assumed from the beginning that the wise of the world would view Christians as fools, and he has not been disappointed. If I have brought any message today, it is this: have the courage to have your wisdom regarded as stupidity. Be fools for Christ, and have the courage to suffer the contempt of the sophisticated world." Close quote. If the idea of seminars about great literature and great ideas appeals to you, don't let our students have all the fun. Join us for the seminars, the ideas, and the conviviality of the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought this June 12th through 17th here in Lander, Wyoming. This year's topic is Mortality and Eternity, the Question of Death. We'll be reading and discussing works from Tolstoy, Homer, Virgil, Dante, Faulkner, and others. And you can find information about the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought on our college website, wyomingcatholic.edu/WSCT. That's wyomingcatholic.edu/WSCT. And in the meanwhile, St. Thomas More, pray for us. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.